It's now 10 minutes past 10. Welcome to Talk of Iowa for this Tuesday, the 23rd. I'm Dennis Reese with the Sleep Doctor, Dr. Eric Dykin, Director of the Sleep Disorder Center at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Dr. Dykin, good morning.
Good morning, Dennis. How are you?
Well, I'm doing fine, and we are live this hour. We'll take your calls at 866-780-9100. Dr. Dykin, I read in the New York Times, a pretty reputable newspaper, column by John Muellum, hard name to say. He says, for years, doctors have been discouraged by Americans' disregard for and mismanagement of their sleep. And he goes on to say, but bragging about how little you sleep, a hallmark of the 80s power broker, it's starting in certain circles to come off as masochistic buffoonery. You know, I've sort of noticed that. People aren't bragging anymore about how little they sleep. Have you noticed that?
Yeah. You know, in fact, with the space shuttle Challenger, when I actually looked at some of the notes, they always talk about catastrophes that may have occurred because of sleep-deprived people who are promoting the takeoff, et cetera, the necessity to get things going early and quickly before being fully prepared. I think it actually was quoted saying, though, while admirable, quote unquote, people who had been working on the liftoff were sleep deprived. And I don't know if that's necessarily admirable. Hard work is admirable, but sometimes sleep deprivation gets to the point of, you know, the fine line between smart and stupid.
And he goes on to say, sleep may finally be claiming its place beside diet and exercise as both a critical health issue and a niche for profitable consumer products. We'll go on maybe to talk about some of those consumer products in a bit. One thing you do, though, at the Sleep Disorder Center, besides seeing patients, a lot of patients, I'm sure, is research. Mm. That's an important component. What do you have going on now to improve the world of sleep for all of us?
Lots and lots and lots of things. We're now involved with a couple of studies on treating excessive sleepiness in shift workers. We're also taking care of a study in regard to people who have developed excessive sleepiness after head trauma, mild to moderate head trauma. And we're actually taking patients now into that study, and I can give you the numbers if you'd like for who they would call if they would like to participate. We are also involved with a study on sleepiness and naps in college students. We're hoping to be funded for that. Does taking a nap, because there's a lot of evidence that Dr. McGregor here over at the university has shown that taking naps and getting sleep makes you perform better if you've prepared well. We also have a couple of studies that will be going on driving safety and sleepiness. Dr. Matt Rizzo and John Tippin just received word that their R01 from the NIH has been accepted for studying this disorder. And also another study we're doing with the National Advanced Driving Stimulator, we have a proposal out to the NIH in regard to treatment of a variety of different things and the effects of sleepiness and safetiness in driving and on sleep-related brainwave changes with the use of caffeine, central nervous system depressants, sleep deprivation, and alcohol. So lots and lots. And if you'd like a number, I can give it to you.
I noticed you were drinking this morning. You're drinking a sparkling water. We have some very fine coffee here, but you walked right by it.
Man, I can smell that coffee. I can smell that caffeine. But after 30 years, 32 years of a caffeine overdose, and I love caffeine. I love coffee. I passed the boards at the Java House. And, you know, well, we have the Java Live presentations with Mr. Kiefer and stuff. Oh, I'll tell you. But I noticed at the end of the day my hands were shaking, and I wasn't sure if I had early Parkinson's. Swear to God, I didn't know. And I stopped drinking, 7 days of bad headache. But I can smell it. That's all I need. But, you know, I've learned to appreciate sparkling water.
But if you stop drinking coffee at, let's say, noon or so, which seems to be a cutoff for a lot of people, it's going to pretty much be out of your system by nighttime, isn't it?
Yeah, half-life, 4 to 6 hours, variable in some people, but that's not the way I drank coffee. I mean, it was a religious thing. 24 hours a day, I didn't care, and it became more than just coffee. So
that's actually a good idea. Just open a bag of beans, leave them in your office just for the aroma, and just kind of maybe let it go.
Oh, man. Oh, I can taste – I can absorb it in the air.
For these studies you mentioned, Dr. Dykin, is there – Is there? I'm sure they're fun, but mm-hmm. is there some compensation maybe for people to take part?
Yeah, there's compensation, you know, and it's an interesting element, the ethics of what we do. What we don't want to do is, for example, if there was a child involved in research, and these studies are all for adults, but if you actually gave such wonderful reimbursement, somebody might actually question the ethics of whether parents were being paid to use their children as guinea pigs. And my thought is, no, of course. We don't promise that this is going to improve anyone's life. Our patients are donating their time. They are taking risks. They are doing what really translates into changing public policy. Doctors help with research. They provide a structure where we can decide something is safe or dangerous. It's the patient, though. It's the individual. It's you and me who's donated the time that really makes the difference. And I have patients who have donated their time, their efforts, and they've improved the health of hundreds of thousands of their brothers and sisters. So patients, we know they're donating to us with this. And they get a little bit of compensation, but it's spitting in the ocean.
Mm-hmm. Forbes magazine says a sleep boom is actually called a sleep racket is underway. I want your comment on this. Business 2.0 website estimates American sleeponomics to be worth $20 billion a year, which includes everything from the more than 1,000 accredited sleep clinics, some of them at spas, conducting overnight tests for disorders like apnea to countless over-the-counter and herbal sleep aids, how-to books, and sleep-encouraging gadgets and talismans. That's an awful lot.
Yeah, yeah.
But there are sleep spas, right?
Oh, you know, it makes me feel so good and clean to have been involved with sleep before it became popular. But then who's going to complain? You know, it's like some of the musicians who say, so you're listening to rock and roll, at least you're listening to music. Yeah, it's a start. And I like rock and roll, by the way, but I also believe in classical training. And the reason we got involved with sleep research back in the early 80s, and we have actually the oldest accredited laboratory in Iowa, continuously accredited from back in 1992, the old ages. But we were interested in the phenomena of people falling asleep, people dying in their sleep. It was morbidly fascinating, and we thought, gosh, if we could turn some of that around, we could save lives and you know, something that seemed to us stupid simple. But as the years have gone by, you know, dream research, et cetera, has just taken off. And my thought is, so there's a little bit of whistles and bells and showbiz, if you will, but it's at least drawing attention to some of the important things. And like with anything else, you don't want to drink too much coffee. It's a very important thing in my life, but if we overdose on coffee, there are bad side effects. So there's at least we're getting attention to the important things. And again, there are some frills and bells, and you can sell some great mattresses out there if you can attract the right customer.
We apparently are having a problem with our phone lines. We're working on that. I know a lot of people have been trying to call in, and as soon as we get that fixed, I'll make the announcement.
You can tell I was dragging all that out just to fix the phone lines.
Now, do you do phone repair, Dr. Tyken, because we could use...
No, but my kids are real good at that stuff.
Not to be too morbid, but you talk about dying in your sleep, but I mean... That doesn't necessarily, you're not necessarily dying from a sleep disorder, are you?
Oh, my goodness. You know, and it almost makes me cry. We showed the first death from sleep apnea in a study we're doing in the critically ill. That was always my research interest because you've seen people like John Candy, Andre the Giant, Jerry Garcia, the bass player for the Blues Traveler. There's a lot of famous people. I have two relatives in their 40s and 50s died in their sleep. And these were all classically overweight, middle-aged men. And we called them Pickwickian because of Charles Dickens' Pickwickian papers, etc., great big heavy sleepy guys who snored like banshees. And we found out, and that's what we were looking at in the early 80s, there appeared to be people waking up with strokes or dying in their sleep. And it was morbidly fascinating. And to a physician and to a healthcare professional, that's what we do, morbidly fascinating stuff. And our thought would be, we could change that wouldn't that be nice? I like John Candy. I like Jerry Garcia. I like to see them alive, but they're not. And I like my relatives. And if you could change that for just a few people, and we showed that many years ago that there was a strong association between untreated obstructive sleep apnea, where you stop breathing in your sleep because of a floppy upper airway, and stroke. And that's been now extended some of the research by Terry Young in Wisconsin, showing that if you have significant apnea, you're at a higher risk of developing hypertension, stroke, and maybe cardiovascular death. And we were in the room with the original fella, and ethically it was a phenomenon to see how do you not treat somebody with bad apnea. But we were looking at all people who were critically ill in the MICU, and this fella was so sick. And he had Alzheimer's. He couldn't speak anymore, and his wife had brought him in at 2 in the morning to bring him to palliative care, to let him go comfortably, living will, et cetera, not to extend life. She said she would let us monitor him, but we couldn't intubate him. We couldn't give him CPAP. We couldn't cardiovert him because there are things, and I agreed with her, that are worse than death. And she brought him here for a comfortable death. And we watched him go to sleep, had horrific apneas, and after a long, prolonged apnea, had what we believe is probably a myocardial infarction, a heart attack. And she came in afterwards, paid her last respects, and it just chokes you up. But that man is the reason people can speculate that Reggie White, the great football player for the Green Bay Packers, the minister, actually may have died of obstructive sleep apnea, a combination of health-related problems. And I think we're circumventing some of these problems. I think we're saving lives now. Third-party payers are recognizing that even poor people need to have their apnea taken care of because a sick, poor person who's tired all the time can't work to contribute to society. And I think that's what we're hoping that Mr. Obama and the politicians are noticing, not just with sleep apnea, but a variety of health issues. And as I said, it's the patient who made the change, mm-hmm. that made a change in policy. And that contribution that our patients give as subjects in research is what makes all the difference. And it's morbidly fascinating. It makes you want to cry, but what a wonderful gift.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Phone lines are up now and working 866, just now they're working, 866-780-9100. That's the number to call to be on the program, not the number to make your pledge. To be on the program, 866-780-9100. One of your research projects you mentioned, Dr. Dykin, is for shift workers. That implies working different shifts, I would assume, and I would think that would be just very, very difficult to deal with, to come up with anything close to a normal sleep pattern if you're being rotated through various shifts. And people who work the graveyard shift, the overnight shifts, how do they do it?
Well, you know, there's a variety of things, and some of us are the terms called morning lark and night owls. We're genetically wired a little different than the people who are really good in the morning and the people who really tend to stay up late. Younger people tend to be phase delayed. They tend to like to stay up later, and their circadian clock that's located deep within the brain tends to be wired so that they can stay up later and maybe are better at shift work. So as we get older, we start dropping out cells from our circadian clock, and we don't handle it as well. But there are unique individuals, and you'll see them. There are nurses who work the night shift who've done it 30, 40 years, and they say, this is the way God made me. And those are the night owls.
Well, so, I've heard that it actually shortens your – I mean, working those overnight shifts shorten people's lives. I've seen that in a couple of places.
You know, in fact, there are studies that have shown that if you get less than 7 hours of sleep on a routine basis, that you have more risks of a variety of morbidities, things that can make you ill, and mortality, things that can make you die, a big variety of things. Also, on the far end of the spectrum, people who sleep much more than 9, 10, 11 hours of sleep also have that same kind of a problem. People with apnea, for example, are usually pathologically sleepy, try to sleep all the time, but they have other things that may be contributing to early demise or other health-related problems, as we've sort of belabored. But, you know, most of us need around 7 to 9 hours of sleep, and we can tell at least initially, we can tell when we can't stay awake during church or at a movie or at a play or driving around 1 to 3 in the afternoon.
Just a few seconds left. What's the length of a perfect nap?
Oh, you know, and that's probably variable from person to person.
Oh, okay.
But try to get less than 30 minutes. Drink your one cup of coffee at the beginning, because if you get into deep non-REM sleep, you get a problem with sleep inertia. We can talk about that later.
Yeah, okay. Well, we need to take a break to do a little bit of business here and the Environment Report. We'll get back to the second half hour with Dr. Daikin in a few minutes here on Iowa Public Radio. Dr. Eric Daikin, Director of the Sleep Disorder Center at the University of Iowa. 1036 Talk of Iowa continues on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Dennis Reese with Dr. Eric Daikin, Director of the Sleep Disorder Center at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. We call him the Sleep Doctor. I hope you appreciate that. I've never asked you whether you actually like that title of Sleep Doctor.
Yeah, it's all right with me.
Is it okay?
Yeah.
Okay. Phone lines are now working, 866-780-9100, or email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Do the seasons make a difference in sleep? Because now we're getting into spring. People may have been used to some really quiet sleeping in the winter. You don't really hear snow much, but you certainly hear spring storms. And it's different. So how does that affect sleep patterns?
Well, you know, the big thing they always ask us about is the seasonal affective disorder, which in the winter months, that shorter exposure to the whole circadian sleep-wake system, which is really entrance through the eyes and the brightness of the sun and the duration of sunlight during a 24-hour period, it really affects the way we are emotionally. And in some people, especially young people, women more than men, there's a tendency to have what we call seasonal affective disorder, where in the winter, with the decreased amount of sunlight, there's less of an effect on this get-up-and-go wake-up system, and our patients become not only very, very sleepy, but they also get very, very depressed, sometimes even to suicidal levels. And they also have, which is sort of unique, most people who are majorly depressed, a melancholic depression, if you will, often have anorexia. They don't eat. These people tend to have carbohydrate craving, and they tend to eat and gain more weight, and they get more sleepy, and they get more depressed. And we often treat that with bright light therapy, try to fool the system, extend the day, often give the bright light, usually in the early morning waking hours, extend the day a little bit, fool the system if you can. But so it does affect the way you feel. But if you love winter, and if you love running outside in the cold and sitting in front of the fire with hot cocoa, my son has a collection of cocos, it's endearing, and you look forward to it. But I had enough of a good thing, and the snow on the weekend was enough for me, and now I'm looking forward to the psychological component of the getting out and running on the trails with my kids and being out more. So there are good things and about every season, but the classic thing for us is the seasonal affective disorder in regard to sleep physiology.
Exercise and sleep. I mean, people in the winter, it's really hard to get exercise unless you can just convince yourself to go down to the treadmill, which is so hard for me to do because it's so dull. But I really like to walk. You can't walk in the winter. It's really hard to get exercise, and that is certainly affecting sleep, isn't it?
Oh, wait a second. You know, I mean, I had the same problem. I have trouble with the treadmill. My wife does okay. But here at the field house, they've got a track upstairs. It's a little bit hard, but I got to see all sorts of friends up there. I forced myself to go up there a few times, and I started running in the afternoon, and I see my kids come up because my daughter's a student over here, and people waved at me. And I think, you know, you can make lemonade out of lemons, but if you look around, it is tougher. Running outside, the risk of slipping on ice and injuring yourself, and then you can just say, well, I'm tired anyway. I'm going to go home and watch TV and eat. And then you get depressed, et cetera. But the malls were great. The field house is great here in Iowa City. But you do have to think a little bit. You have to plan a little bit because of the weather. And sometimes you just give up and get depressed.
Okay. Let's go to our first caller in this segment. John is calling from the Quad Cities. Good morning, John.
Hi. I've often wondered, is there one organic center in the brain, an organ, if you will, that controls sleep, or is it the systematic, the brain is all working together to do this?
Well, it's both of those things. And the neat thing is there is a great big system. It's called the reticular activating system that sort of keeps you awake and asleep.
Okay.
But Von Economo, now he's sort of our hero. There was this, you might have seen Awakenings movie that had Robert De Niro in it and who's that comedian, Robin Williams.
Yeah.
They sort of embellished this, but Von Economo, back around 1918, there was a horrific encephalitis that killed hundreds of thousands of people throughout the world. And in the people who survived, some were left with permanent sleepiness, some were left with permanent insomnia. And what Von Economo did, and this was simple observation leads to great science, it's morbidly fascinating. He would go to the people who had the permanent sleepiness, and he'd go to the people who had the permanent insomnia and said, I think that encephalitis destroyed a waking or a sleeping center in your brain. When you die, can I do an autopsy on you and look at your brain and see if there is a center or an organ, as you inferred, implied? And they say, yeah. And what he found, and again, it's part of the system, and it's an entry into the system, that the specific area called the preoptic nucleus and the hypothalamus was a sleeping center. So if you wiped it out, you had permanent insomnia. He saw that. Then he found that the lateral nucleus of the hypothalamus, it was a waking center. If you wipe that out, then you have permanent sleepiness. So actually, it's more complicated than that, but what a great way to try to find what we now call the sleep switch and the wake switch that works with the whole system.
So there is an organic aspect to this thing. There
Absolutely.
Is actual chemistry involved in this.
Yeah. And that's why we're doing the study on the head trauma people. If you really get hit in the head, like you've been in a car wreck or shaken by someone, it can disrupt these areas, cause permanent sleepiness or wakefulness. And there are medications that try to mimic in a holistic fashion the real neurotransmitters that should have been there. And that's why we do promote certain medications in certain cases.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Great. Thanks.
Yeah, pretty neat.
All righty. Thank you. I appreciate that call very much.
That was fun.
From John, who called from the Quad Cities. Let's go next to Patty in Des Moines. Good morning, Patty.
I wake up every morning at 10, no matter what time I go to bed. It seems my brain starts firing after dark. I don't have children, and I need to start getting up earlier so I can join civilization. I'm groggy if I wake up any earlier, it seems.
Well, you know, there is an interesting phenomenon that our sleep patterns normally change as we age. And infants, for example, newborns, they're ultradian instead of a circadian. They have sleep-wake schedules and cycles 4 or 5 times throughout the day. Then by 1 year, they're often sleeping, you know, overnight. You sort of nature intend us to be sleeping. And usually by age 9 to 12, kids are getting, you know, like 9 to 12 hours of sleep. And then usually when they become young adults, they're sleeping the 7 to 9 hours we sort of implied. But adolescents, they tend to be what we call phase delayed. They tend to be wired at that age to stay up late and sleep in late. And we always say, oh, my son is just so lazy. He's just staying up too late. God knows what he's doing on the internet and with that Game Boy, and he should be getting to bed earlier. Well, try to get a kid to go to bed early on Christmas Eve or Hanukkah or whatever you got. On a special day, you're going to go to Disney World, and you say, I want you to go to bed early. Can't be done. They're not wired to do it. Then they're excited about, you know, staying up for something, and they're phase delayed. Now, when we get older, we drop out cells from that central circadian rhythm center, the biologic clock, and we tend to, when we get in our 70s and 80s and maybe even our 50s, that's what I've done, go to bed earlier and wake up earlier. And I'll tell you, I'm just like you, but I'm phase advanced. I'm getting a little bit older. Over age 50 is when we start dropping out some of those cells and noticing these changes, just like my problems that I have with accommodation, having to wear the bifocals. Those things happen. And for me, it's great because I wake up at 4:45 every morning. I don't need a clock. And I get a couple hours of study done, preparation, clean up the basement. I do my part of the dishes. My wife washes them at night, and I put them away in the morning, take care of the dog. And it works for me. But, you know, sometimes there's other interests we have at night. We have irregular bed times, waking times. We try to stay up late on the weekends so we can stay out at the party and stay with the kids and the family members. But the way my work life works out right now, I'm at phase advanced and I work well with it. But as you've implied, though, and you got to be careful when you listen to any doctor telling you the way it is on the radio, every one of us is a little bit different. And there's a variety of reasons why a person like you might be staying up later than she wants to and might be sleeping in later than she wants to. And before doctors start giving you holistic medicines to fix you, maybe you should sit down with your general practitioner, look at a sleep diary and say, you know, this is what I want. I want to go to bed at 10 and wake up at 6, for example. I don't like going to bed at 2 and waking up at 10. My life stinks. What can you do for me, doc? The general practitioner, 99% of the things that haven't made sense to you, they can address. And then if it doesn't make sense to them, then every once in a while you need a specialist to have you sent to Iowa City for and make you spend $1 million. But most of it's common sense. Obviously, this has got beyond common sense for you. I'd sit down with your general doc, go over that full history and examination, and see what the doc thinks.
Okay, Patty, anything else?
Maybe start a half an hour at a time earlier, just, you know, like, or rip it off like a Band-Aid and just start getting up at 7?
Well, actually, you know, like I just mentioned, if you're not sleepy to begin with, try to go to bed a half hour earlier, and what you'll do is you'll have pure misery. Try to go to bed early and count sheep. I tried that. Oh, and then you'll actually fall asleep later. They've done these studies. Sometimes people try to phase delay, and what they'll do is they'll stay up a half hour earlier one day, and then they'll stay later one day. Then the next night they'll stay up a half hour later until they go around the clock a little backwards so that they're up all night almost one night. But then they finally get to the bedtime from the other extreme where they're staying up almost all day, and then they're finally going to sleep at that set bedtime. Did that translate well? Do you understand what I'm saying there?
It doesn't matter what time I go to bed.
Mm-hmm.
It just matters what time I get up. I get just 4 hours of sleep. I still wake up at 10. My eyes open at the 10.
You know, and there is a phenomena about that because the bright light comes out, and unless you got blackout curtains, that light is going to still seep in, and it's going to have a stimulatory effect on your melatonin, on that circadian system, et cetera. And as I implied, there are other issues that make you wake up even if you are a bit sleep deprived. And my thought would be maybe sit down with the doc before I get you into any more trouble, go over a good sleep diary, and talk about common sense and all your other health-related issues.
Patty, thanks a lot. Appreciate the call. Patty calling from the Quad Cities. Here is from Des Moines. Here's an email from William in Davenport. He says he works 12 midnight to 8:30 a.m. shift. He finds himself sleeping 3 or 4 hours after work at 8:30 a.m. and 2 or 3 hours before work. He says, I struggled for some time to get used to this schedule, but I've recently come across some research in audio brainwave therapy that seems to help. I now use a CD of rainfall embedded with bioral beats to encourage delta wave sleep, and I feel more refreshed and rested after 3 or 4 hours than I did when I slept 6 or 7 hours straight. Would you please address the impact of delta and the other wave inducements on sleep quality?
Well, you know, there's a lot of different ways to increase deep delta sleep. There's a lot of people believe, because as we get older, we tend to lose deep delta sleep, and then we tend to have more sleep problems. They try to say, well, that must be the most refreshing stage of sleep. But it seems to be very important. And some of the ways you can increase deep delta sleep is, again, being relaxed. And one of the things that music may do, it may be something that really works for you. For me, it might be a little bit something with a faster beat instead of rain, especially if you've been in hurricanes. Rain sometimes is a negative thing. Something that is pleasing to the individual may actually help them get to sleep. The other thing, having that bioral stimulation, it often masks out any environmental noise. And if you're trying to sleep during the day, and I've done a lot of shift work because of the research we do, oh, I can't sleep during the day because the cat's up, the dog's up, there's someone ringing on the doorbell, there's a telephone call. And that can actually mask some of those environmental sounds that screw up my sleep when I'm trying to sleep during the day. There's a lot to what you just brought up. It's something obviously pleasant to you. It's got a positive reinforcement. It can mask out certain things, and that may improve your sleep and do really well for you. Some people, though, when you try to put on like earplugs or even things over the ears, that discomfort may be a negative thing for them. One of the things we talked about earlier was low-level exercise, which actually increases core body temperature and will often increase deep delta sleep if you've exercised 4 to 7 hours prior to going to sleep or early in the morning. And if you're not much of an exerciser, furo, the hot bath, the sauna, whirlpool, if you do that for about 15 minutes, many hours before going to sleep, it also can increase your core body temperature and increase deep delta sleep. And it's aesthetically pleasing to some of us.
Let's go next to Louise in Fairfield. Louise, you're on the program. Are you there, Louise? No, let's go to Dave in Des Moines. Dave, are you there? Well, we lost both of them. I think I do have another email, so if you'll give me a second, I will go to that as soon as I find it. Okay, this is an email from Jeff, who's calling from Illinois. He says he's wondering if there's a way to tell when my body is exhausted and needs more sleep, that it feels impossible to wake up as opposed to just being extra sleepy. I also get that impossible to wake feeling when I take a nap, which often ends up lasting 4 hours when I only want it to last for about 15 to 30 minutes. Now, you said a four-hour nap. That's way too long, right?
Well, and it all depends. If you're taking a four-hour nap, you probably did some big-time sleep deprivation. So the body, again, most of us physiologically, we need 7 to 9 hours of sleep. There are people at the feet of the bell-shaped curve, if you will. Some people can get by with 3 or 4 hours of sleep on a routine basis, and some people need over 10 to 12 hours of sleep. And that's the real problem in our society. But if you're a bit sleep-deprived and you need to take a nap, Dr. Bill Dement, one of the number one sleep disorder guy in the world from Stanford, one of my mentors, helped me get tenured here at the University of Iowa. He said, Eric, what you do is you drink your coffee right at the beginning of your nap, because it takes about a half hour for that caffeine to kick in to wake you up. And the next thing you do is set that alarm about a half hour. That'll prevent you to getting into deep delta sleep, because if you get into deep delta sleep, that's refreshing sleep. Your body's going to really fight to wake up, and you will feel worse than when you first started that nap, because you're going to feel, gosh, I mean, I'm feeling deader than I did before I went to sleep. And that's the sleep inertia that we were implying earlier in the show. If you sleep too long, sometimes you can actually get into a deeper stage of sleep that's harder to arouse from, like almost being in a coma, and you just go, oh, this stunk. And sometimes you can do that in the morning where you just want another 30 minutes, just another 40 minutes, and it gets you out of that deep delta sleep, and then you wake up from a shallower stage of sleep and you don't feel as bad.
Let's try to get one more call, quick call in from Harold. He's calling from Fairfield. Hello.
Morning.
Yeah. Do you have a quick question for Dr. Dyke?
Yes, I do. Especially during the wintertime, but most times of the year. If I get a little cold at night, I can pull on an extra blanket and I'll finally get to sleep. But I've been finding lately I'm having a hard time waking up if I'm starting to get too hot under the blanket. I end up with having dreams like I'm drowning in a bathtub. And when I do finally wake up, I can't breathe.
Hey, Harold, how much do you weigh?
220.
Yeah, how tall are you?
6'2".
About 6'2", so you're not that big of a guy. I'm about 170, and the only reason I bring that up, you know, there's a lot of things, a million things, literally a billion things you can think of that can help your sleep, hurt your sleep, loud noise, too hot, too cold, etc. But years ago, around Thanksgiving, when Grandma came over and I could eat, and then we were getting those Guinness stouts right before sleep, I had two dreams in a one-week period where my doctor, my back doctor, told me to try to sleep on my back because of some problems I was having. I woke up dreaming I was drowning, and I woke up and I couldn't breathe, and that's how I found out I had sleep apnea. So we sort of jumped from coldness to apnea, but talk to your doctor, have him look down your throat and see if the apnea should be looked at.
All right. Thank you for the call, Harold, from Fairfield. Dr. Daikin, thanks very much for the time. We appreciate it. Dr. Eric Daikin, director of the Sleep Disorders Center, University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Our sleep doctor. We'll see you again soon, Dr. Daikin. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. We had help today from our student assistant, Christoph Mai.